From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, jocks, nerds, cowboys, rebels, and businessmen. Richard Martin looks at men's styles of the 20th century and brings a cultural historian's perspective to fashion. Also today, climatologist Stephen Schneider tells us what science knows and doesn't know about the greenhouse effect. His new book, Global Warming, looks at what's in store for the planet. Rock historian Ed Ward examines Sly Stone's work as a record producer, and book critic John Leonard reviews John Gregory Dunn's new memoir. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Almost half of the East Germans seeking refuge in West German embassy in Prague returned home today. Some of them have been in the embassy since mid-April. Deidre Berger reports.
The East Germans left today after discussions with East German human rights lawyer Wolfgang Vogel. He promised them immunity from prosecution, a return to their jobs, and extensive legal aid on immigration applications. A similar agreement last week with Vogel persuaded 117 East Germans to leave the West Berlin mission in East Berlin. 240 East Germans are still holed up in the Prague embassy, hoping to get exit visas to the West. Meanwhile, West German officials say 11,000 East Germans have come from Hungary to West Germany the past 2 days. The East German government criticized the Hungarian government again today and asked Budapest to retract its decision to open its borders to East Germans. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger reporting in Passau, West Germany.
Drug Policy Director William Bennett said today President Bush's war on drugs could cost $50 billion over the next 5 years. Bennett was responding to Democratic charges that Bush's plan will fail to curb drug abuse and related violence. Bennett told a congressional panel that $8 billion sought by the president was only the beginning. Bennett gave no hint that Bush had changed his opposition to increasing taxes to pay for the war on drugs, as some Democrats have suggested. The authorities in Colombia have released two more suspected members of the Medellin drug cartel who are due to be extradited to face charges in the U.S. Alan Tomlinson reports from Bogota.
Bernardo Londoño Quintana and Alberto Holandez Gamboa were among hundreds arrested 3 weeks ago when the Colombian government began its latest crackdown on the country's cocaine cartels. Both men are understood to be wanted in the United States on charges of laundering drug money through American banks. President Virgilio Barco's special cabinet counsel on drugs announced that the two suspects would be extradited. But it has now been learned that local judges in towns where the two men were being held ordered their release on grounds of insufficient evidence linking them to narcotics crimes. Another so-called extraditable was freed last week. The release orders call into question the ability of the Colombian government to carry out its controversial extradition policy. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Tomlinson in Bogota.
The House voted overwhelmingly today to limit the right of Americans to demonstrate by making it a crime to burn the flag. Legislation aimed at countering a recent Supreme Court ruling that flag burning is constitutionally protected free speech. Procter & Gamble said today it'll be paid a record total of $125 million by three of the nation's biggest food makers for violating its patent on crisp and chewy cookies. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 2 points. This is NPR News. Illinois Governor James Thompson has signed into law legislation repealing the state's controversial premarital AIDS testing law. Eileen McIntyre of member station WBEZ in Chicago has details.
The governor's action means couples planning to marry in Illinois will no longer have to submit to a mandatory premarital AIDS test. Thompson has signed legislation before leaving on a two-week European trip that repeals the controversial law, the first of its kind in the nation. Critics of the law that took effect in January of 1988 say the cost of the test was prohibitive and drove couples seeking marriage licenses to neighboring states. State health officials argued the law was not worth the exodus. In all, 52 people tested positive for the AIDS virus out of a quarter of a million people tested. For National Public Radio, I'm Eileen McIntyre in Chicago.
A group of scientists and U.S. officials said today that tracking AIDS patients' white blood cell counts may help researchers cut down the time needed to evaluate experimental AIDS drugs. an account in the blood of a particular type of disease-fighting white cell known as CD4 or T4 cells appears to correlate with an AIDS patient's chances for survival. While medical researchers have long looked at CD4 counts as one indication of an AIDS patient's condition, the consensus on their importance in gauging the patient's response to a new drug is new and could carry great weight with government drug regulators. Soviet political rebel Boris Yeltsin met briefly today with President Bush after publicly urging the administration to help salvage Mikhail Gorbachev's political and economic reforms. The White House said Bush told Yeltsin his administration enjoys a very positive relationship with Soviet President Gorbachev and reiterated support for perestroika. Yeltsin, a critic of Gorbachev, has emerged as the leader of a small but vocal group of reformers within the newly constituted Soviet parliament. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Whether or not you think of yourself as fashionable, every time you get dressed or go shopping, you're making a choice, and that choice says something about how you see yourself and your social role. My guest Richard Martin is the co-author of Jocks and Nerds, A Visual History of Men's Style in the 20th Century, and an analysis of the cultural trends that inspired those looks. He writes about the styles that borrowed from athletes, intellectuals, cowboys, military men, businessmen, dandies, rebels, and workers. His previous book, Fashion and Surrealism, chronicled the influence of the art movement on designers. Both Jocks and Nerds and Fashion and Surrealism were also shows curated by Martin at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York, where he's the dean of graduate studies. Martin is also a former editor of Arts Magazine. Welcome to Fresh Air. As an art historian, how do you think you're looking at fashion differently from, say, people in the fashion world?
I think from a very different kind of perhaps objective point of view, although it certainly has its own biases to it. I think it's really being able to look at fashion in a kind of analytical way. After all, fashion has certain ways of being seen. We all participate in fashion to some degree. We wear clothing. We make decisions about it every day. There must be some way of looking at those kinds of decisions.
Mm-hmm. Your book, Jocks and Nerds, is about men's style in the 20th century, and I think it's fair to say that the biggest change in men's style of the 20th century is that there's different styles. I mean, it's gone beyond like one uniform for everybody.
I think you're right. I think that there is a multiplicity of styles and that men make very deliberate choices about style, not in a way which says, oh, I'm going to wear one particular item or another, but it really is determined by certain kinds of social choices. If you can think about men that you know who get really fixed upon a garment, certain men will have a bomber jacket that they have attached romance to. And the romance of wearing that jacket becomes something evocative every time they put it on, something heroic, just about going to the market. Or the guy who's wearing the bush jacket, something that looks as if he's going off to expedition in Africa, even if he's only doing the shopping. We can have a tremendous romantic attachment, a sense of aspiration about clothing. Men very often like to imagine that it's women who fantasize through clothing. I would argue it's just the opposite, that women can create roles through clothing, but that men really create their magic through clothing. And this applies to those men who are dressing in a conservative way, in which they know that they're going to wear the right kind of gray suit in order to succeed at business, or it can be the man who is wearing the same outfit he wore 20 years ago when he was 21 years old.
Why is that happening now? I mean, I don't think you could say that was so true earlier in the 20th century.
I think because of a remarkable stability about men's clothing, that in fact men can continue to buy almost the same garment over a period, long period of time. That if you want to dress as Joe College, it's now a very stable role. Some aspects of it will change, but you can still find your Basswegians, you can still find your chinos, there's always a rumpled tweed jacket, there's always some kind of cardigan sweater you can throw on. Not so different than what men were wearing in the 1930s, or the kind of Joe College image we have even from the movies, from Jimmy Stewart in the 1930s.
I think one of the interesting changes in men's fashion and in ads for men's fashion is men's underwear. And it's only in the past decade or two that we've seen these, like designer briefs. Like, there's always been almost a fetish about women's underwear, and men always wore baggy jockey shorts or BVDs. Why do you think that change is happening? The kind of well, in a way, it's a visual sexualizing of men in fashion and in advertising.
I think very much so. In the same way in which we're able to look at gender in the last decade in a very different way than we've looked at it before. I think we're doing it in academic terms, we're doing it in social terms, and perhaps those are the real generative ones. But what is really happening is that we're able to look at men, able to say that we've always said that men are the spectators and women are the object of what one is looking at. But it can also work the other way. Men can be looked at too. That's what's happened in terms of fashion advertising. For a long period of time, certainly since the Second World War, the primary purchaser of men's undergarments has been women. They buy them as gifts for men. It makes it very logical then that women delight in the kind of advertising that shows a handsome, attractive man in the underwear. And of course, in fact, men, if they could express themselves, might even find that attractive as too, at least as a kind of role model.
Well, you know, there's always been a lot of gay men in the fashion industry, and I wonder if, since so many gay men have come out of the closet, if that's influenced the vision of men in the fashion world now, the way men are displayed in a more sexual way in fashion.
I think that may be a factor, but I think of it really as a somewhat larger issue. When you think that in many of the sports that we have, much more of the body is revealed than it was for men or women 20 or 30 years ago, that now we have a kind of body awareness for men. The most macho man may be going to a gym, and a gym that may have mirrors around. It's not that it's really there for vanity, at least we say that. But really that idea of judging oneself against some kind of model of a perfect male.
If you're just joining us, my guest is art historian Richard Martin, who writes about fashion and fashion history, and his latest book is called Jocks and Nerds. Now, speaking of jocks, you know, you write about the influence of sports on fashion, and this, perhaps more than any other time, at least in the 20th century, is a time when athletes are having an incredible influence on how men and women dress. What are some of the examples of that that you'd cite now?
I think when you see people wearing those cotton mesh shirts out on the street that you know come directly off of the football field, and that one of the things that's happened in sports in the last decade or so is that a great many of them have had advances in the technology of clothing. And that technology of clothing transfers immediately to the street. And it transfers in some cases to kids, to messengers who are running around, but then it transfers very rapidly to the entire population. It's not entirely a new phenomenon, though. We know that when René Lacoste developed in the 1920s and 1930s a tennis shirt that was comfortable, fitted to the canon of the white garments worn on the tennis court, but allowed a little bit more freedom and allowed as well the garment to absorb some of the moisture from the body. This was really a great technological advance, which we think of as the Lacoste shirt even today. And the polo players use it, so the polo or tennis shirts have really been a staple, particularly of men's wardrobes for more than 50 years now. And a great deal of what we think of as street clothing or leisure clothing in the latter part of the 20th century has its genesis in having been worn for sports.
Sneakers. I remember when I was growing up, you bought sneakers, and now there's so many different hip kinds of sneakers to wear, and depending on where you live and who you are, you have to have the right kind. Do you know anything about the history of the sneaker?
Oh, again, it's really a very interesting history, which I can't cite entirely for you, but it really relates to the history of vulcanized rubber, and I think it's the U.S. Ked Company in the 1920s, again, that was doing great experiments. But it's very true what you say about the wearing of sneakers. When I was a child, one, you know, you had sneakers at school or you wore them for gym class, and all the rest of the time you had to wear hard-soled shoes. It's hard for me now to imagine that if you see a bunch of kids, almost everybody's wearing sneakers. And not only the kids, then a lot of adults too are discovering that they're a wonderful way of dressing. And that's come to us in part through jogging, but I think through the whole sports and fitness awareness that we've had in the 1970s and 1980s.
Now, you write about the nerd look. What would you describe as the nerd look?
I think the quintessential nerd, as one thinks about it, is someone who's wearing high-water pants. The pants aren't quite long enough. They're hiked up very high on the waist. It's wearing a short-sleeve shirt, but probably a sweater or some kind of sweater vest, with the sense of real disparity that the forearms are exposed, but the body is all covered up, as if it's too hot on the torso and a little bit chilly around the edges. A sense of real physical discomfort. And perhaps with that would go thick glasses as well, and particularly thick dark rims, as if to accentuate the slight discomfort and alienation of the nerd.
Do you think that the nerd look has become almost hip in the past few years?
I think that certainly is true. What had been a disparaged figure in the 1950s really became, and largely I think through rock music, a figure who could be a real model by the 1980s. I think one first saw it through figures in music, a kind of slightly adverse downtown style where it seemed very hip to be a little bit outrageous as a nerd. And then ultimately it's come back to being a quite acceptable style. I think going along with that is really the sense that the nerd represents not only the arts, but also science and technology. Science and technology, which in a traditional interpretation 20, 30 years ago might have seemed to be alien. Now we embrace it. We embrace it in terms of PCs. We embrace it in terms of knowing perhaps more about technology and user-friendly technology. In that transformation, the nerd, who has known about computers perhaps since Alfred E. Newman, now becomes essential information for all of us, and it may well be that that nerd that we disparaged back in high school is going to be our employer.
You credit Pee Wee Herman as helping to bring the look in, and you mentioned other people in television and in movies who have inspired certain fashion changes. One that I really hadn't thought of is Humphrey Bogart as being responsible for making the trench coat fashionable.
Yes, that great scene, particularly in Casablanca, of wearing of the trench coat. And that's a good case of how there's been such an odyssey, really, of how a male garment has gone from its first use, which was as a military outfit, very adaptable to trench warfare at the time of the First World War. At that time, because the jacket had so many pockets in it, it was very good for carrying things because of the density of the material. It would shed most water and mud. It then became a kind of valorous and limited to officers in the First World War. Then by the 1930s, the films in particular had picked up on the idea that it was a kind of espionage foreign correspondent. And Joel McRae, as I recall, in Foreign Correspondent, wears a trench coat, and then Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca. That sense of the intrepid individual really being captured wearing a trench coat. So it becomes a real modernized version of a kind of swashbuckler. And I still think that when men wear trench coats today, there's something about that buckling of the belt, there's something about having all of that apparatus that has a real sense of style to it. And that wonderful thing that's often associated with men of style, which is utility, that there's a real reason. It's not a contrivance, but there's a real reason for all that style.
Mm-hmm. Clark Gable is famous for having made the undershirt popular because of And It Happened One Night when he takes off his shirt. What was the status of the undershirt before that?
Well, actually, when he in It Happens One Night, he takes off his outer shirt and he's wearing no undershirt. So, in fact, what happened was that the undershirt industry was devastated by that. And it was the first time which men, in many cases, did not wear undershirts.
Oh, I have the story all
wrong. But it's interesting because it's a time at which undershirts became popular for another reason, though, which is then by the 40s, they're being worn as outer shirts. So that men are going back and forth between what they do and do not wear. But largely because of that kind of association. If it is an association with what one wears in It Happened One Night, then you find that you can wear an undershirt again in approximately 1951, I think, in A Streetcar Named Desire, because
right.
Marlon Brando wears an undershirt, and it's so dramatic, and it's thought to be a kind of ideal of the male.
Well, let's talk more about fashion after we take a short break. And my guest is art historian Richard Martin, who is also at the Fashion Institute of Technology, where he has curated several shows, including Jocks and Nerds and Fashion and Surrealism. And those are both also titles of books that he co-wrote Each are published by Rizzoli. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We're talking about some of the cultural forces at work in the world of fashion, and my guest is art historian Richard Martin. Here's one of the great questions of menswear in the 20th century. Why is it, you touch on this in Jocks and Nerds, why is it that conservative upper-class men who dress very conservatively through the week, you know, basic gray suit or whatever, on the weekends will sometimes wear lime green pants or red and green plaid pants, really loud pants.
Yes. I think it is, as you say, one of the great questions, and probably inexplicable in a way, except by that wonderful sense of contrast, that these are the men who really have a canon of behavior imposed upon them during the week. They dress in a certain way, and then it is as if they can define bad taste as clearly as they define good taste. It seems to be a kind of extreme. And they wear decoration, those things that we tend not to associate with masculinity, those things we tend not to associate with the upper class. It's almost as if they contrive to be as outrageous as possible. But I wonder if, in not answering the question, but perhaps in providing a thought, simply that it may be that in some ways, because fashion is about utility, but it always is a little bit about a kind of fantasy, not really about what we are, but about some sense of projection. And there may be some kind of great fantasy that these men are creating for themselves as they go off to the woods in the most bizarre of outfits.
You know, we've talked a little bit about fashion that comes from the top down, from the designers or from Hollywood, that filters down to the popular level. But fashion also works the other way. A lot of fashion starts from the street, and then designers pick up on it. Do you see more of that happening now, and where do you trace that back to?
I think very much so. I think probably it's always been there to some degree. When you think about what Chanel did even in the 1920s and 1930s, she was getting some of her ideas from not only from menswear, but from vernacular dress that she was then applying to high style. But certainly you find it in the 1970s and 1980s. It came in part, I think, in a most pronounced way with the phenomenon of jeans. The jeans, which had been identified with the worker, really became something that became designer jeans for a period of time. Interestingly enough, I think now we don't think about designer jeans in that same way in which we did even a decade ago, but that's become a kind of modification. It's a little bit street. Some of the classic styles of jeans have been returned, and many people wear them again, and they are in some competition then with a kind of modified designer jeans. But I think one sees many ways in which designers are taking their ideas from what people wear in the street. When punk was a phenomenon in London, you saw Japanese designers like Rei Kawakubo deriving ideas from punk. Her so-called lace sweater, a torn sweater, really comes out of the torn garments that she had seen in London streets. Jean-Paul Gaultier took extreme ideas to the French couture, really off the London streets and punk. And here in the United States, Stephen Sprouse, to some degree, brought those ideas into 80s design.
Don't you find it somewhat absurd when that happens, when an anti-fashion statement like punk suddenly filters up and gets codified into an expensive fashion statement?
I think it is, yes, it is strange and it's paradoxical, except I have to admit, as someone who personally wouldn't wear true street fashion, and yet I admire it very often, it's as close as I'll get to it. Maybe I need the designer label on the torn sweater in order to wear it.
Well, since you brought up your clothes, let me explain what you're wearing. You're wearing a gray pinstripe suit. Is it double breasted?
Single
breasted, and a silk black and white tie.
Yes.
Silk.
Not what a fashion person is supposed to wear, I think.
Fashion people are supposed to dress more flamboyantly.
Well, that would be one's cliche, but I think ironically, most fashion people dress very conservatively. There are many of the designers who wear almost exactly the same garment day after day, both male and female designers, and who seemingly don't have fashion for themselves, but of course project it for others. I think there's something very reassuring about a kind of uniform. And there's no doubt that I think many people select a garment that really becomes their standard, so we're able to identify them by the clothing at a distance. You see someone coming along and you say, that's the basic silhouette of a friend. You recognize them immediately through the clothing. And there are many people, I think, who do have this funny relationship to fashion, which is to enjoy fashion, but at the same time to also to enjoy a kind of anti-fashion.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were telling me before we went on the air that you wear very similar clothes to work day after day. Do you find a certain reassurance in doing that?
I do. I mean, I think I'm identifiable to people. They know every time they see me I'm going to be wearing a suit during business hours. And I think if one behaved erratically in terms of clothing, it would be difficult to identify someone. I think none of us really behave erratically in terms of clothing. It may be we dress very differently on a Friday going to work than we do the following day when we're going out to the country. But often there is a kind of predictability. And I think the reason for that really is that clothing participates so much in what we are as individuals. We can't change our personalities from one day to another. I would feel uncomfortable sitting with you wearing a purple suit or something outlandish, the way people did, of course, both men and women in the late 1960s and early 1970s. But I never did at that time. Mm-hmm. I certainly would not feel comfortable talking with you in that way.
In the 12 different types that you have listed in your latest book, Jocks and Nerds and Military Men and Joe Collegiate, where do you see yourself?
It's interesting. I suppose I should fit into one of the categories, but I have to admit I think I fit into a number of the categories, as many men do. And I know that for the exhibition itself, we were suddenly looking for an old pair of black denims for to dressing a rebel mannequin, and I had those and an old velvet suit of mine went under the dandy category. So a lot of my old clothes appeared in there under different categories. So maybe, like all men, and I think like all people who are aware of clothing, that really one fits into several roles.
We only have a few seconds left, but I know when I go shopping for clothes, I always walk away feeling really frustrated because the things you want don't fit. And then, especially in women's clothes, there's all these like dumb styles that you really don't want to wear. In the 30 seconds we have left, do you ever get frustrated like that? Or can you avoid that by dressing the same way day after day?
I have to tell you, and I oughtn't tell you, but I really don't buy my own clothing. I go to somebody in a store who buys all my clothing for me, and basically I depend upon someone else, which may show that ultimately, as much as I love fashion, maybe I'm even a little bit intimidated by it too.
Well, on that note, I thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been art historian Richard Martin. His books include Fashion and Surrealism and Jocks and Nerds. Both are published by Rizzoli Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, actor Donald Sutherland. His films include MASH, Ordinary People, Casanova, Clute, and the new film, A Dry White Season. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This has been the hottest decade on record. Scientists are debating whether or not it's the result of the so-called greenhouse effect. Coming up, some informed speculation from climatologist Stephen Schneider, author of Global Warming, Are We Entering the Greenhouse Century? Most people remember Sly Stone as the outrageous leader of a rock and soul band, but rock historian Ed Ward tells us about Sly's genius as a producer. And book critic John Leonard reviews Harp, writer John Gregory Dunn's new memoir. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. An American Airlines jet carrying 104 passengers and 6 crew members from Rochester, New York, crashed on landing at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport tonight. There are conflicting reports on the number of injuries, but none appears to be serious. Officials at O'Hare say the nose gear on the 3-engine MD-80 collapsed as the plane landed. In Namibia, police have begun a search for the man who assassinated a senior official in the nationalist movement SWAPO. NPR's John Madison reports from Cape Town.
A red sedan stopped outside the suburban home of SWAPO's most senior white official, attorney Anton Lebowski. Lebowski was shot in the head several times at close range with an AK-47. Lebowski stayed in Namibia throughout its war of independence, defending SWAPO officials in political trials and speaking out on behalf of SWAPO. Recently made a tour through South Africa, presenting SWAPO's economic policies to South African business people. He was expected to become a senior official in his country's first post-independence government. Lebowski's death has increased fears for the safety of other leaders of the movement. Several of the organization's top officials returned from exile yesterday, and SWAPO President Sam Nujoma is expected in Namibia on Thursday. I'm John Madison in Cape Town.
The Senate has approved the nomination of Donald Gregg as ambassador to South Korea. Gregg was national security advisor to then-Vice President George Bush during the Iran-Contra affair. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Donald Gregg served 31 years in the CIA, 2 years as chief of station in Seoul, South Korea. His nomination was controversial because of suspicions that he misled the Congress in sworn testimony about the extent of Vice President Bush's knowledge of key information in the Iran-Contra affair. One of Gregg's best friends, Felix Rodriguez, actively supplied the Contras at a time when U.S. aid was illegal. Although his personal memos to then-Vice President Bush carry notations about the supply of the Contras, Gregg has denied he informed his boss of the covert activity. Donald Gregg's nomination as ambassador to South Korea was confirmed by a vote of 66-33. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
There are indications a congressional probe of the generic drug industry is now expanding. The chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, John Dingell, has signaled the probe will also include the makers of brand-name products, and the first target is to be Eli Lilly and Company. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 2.5 points in light trading of 143 million shares. The state of Illinois has taken off the books the nation's only law requiring premarital AIDS testing. In the nearly 2 years that the law was in effect, thousands of couples left the state to get married elsewhere. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air.
One that's done all the things you set out to do. Stand.
There's a cross for you to bear.
Things to go through if you're going anywhere. Stand.
Next to James Brown, Sly Stone may be the performer most sampled by rappers and scratchers. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says this is testimony to the fact that Sly's rhythm section, Larry Graham and Greg Errico, played beats that inspired many of today's funk musicians. Today, Ed explores Sly Stone's work as a producer.
The other day, somebody pointed out to me that the difference between Woodstock and the Monterey Pop Festival, which he felt was the superior event, was that Monterey had introduced at least one superb black artist to pop fans, Otis Redding. while the only black performer with black appeal on the Woodstock stage was Sly Stone. Well, sorry, old pal, but you're missing the point. Sly Stone was not a soul artist. He was, as the title of his first album put it, a whole new thing, and he'd been working on becoming a whole new thing for some time. Sly, whose given name is Sylvester Stewart, was born in Dallas, but moved to Vallejo, California as a very young child. He had his first hit record, a gospel tune, in 1960 at the age of 16. Not long after that, while studying at Vallejo Junior College, he made the switch to soul, working nights in seedy East Bay clubs while teaching himself how to play every instrument he could get his hands on. His break came in early 1964. He'd been a DJ using the name Sly Stone on KSOL, and through his radio connections met Tom Big Daddy Donahue and Bobby Mitchell, who ruled San Francisco's number one top 40 station, KYA. They wanted to start a record label, and in keeping with the times, one of the major things they wanted to record was soul music. They knew they could spot talent, but they needed a producer. 20-year-old Sly said he'd be happy to help, and sat down to write, arrange, produce, and play on Autumn Records' first hit.
Come on, everybody! Come on in! Bobby's gonna show you how to do the swim! Kinda like the monkey, kinda like the twist. Pretend you're in the water.
It was loud, it exploited a dance craze, and it established Bobby Freeman, who sang it, Mitchell and Donahue's Autumn record label, and the kid they paid $150 a week to do the dirty work, Sly Stone. But Sly probably didn't mind. He was learning stuff he could never have learned at Vallejo Junior College and making his own records under his own name. Well, nobody said they had to be brilliant. And although Sly produced soul records by people like Bertha Tillman, Gloria Scott, and Billy Preston, Mitchell and Donahue made certain he paid attention to the local rockers, too. Mojo Men's Dance With Me was a decent-sized local hit, not as big as the version of Sit Down, I Think I Love You they'd have a year later on Warner Brothers, but not bad. But by late 1965, it was becoming evident to Sly that he'd better make some plans. Autumn was falling apart, and after spending hours in the studio doing 50 takes of a song called Somebody to Love by one of the hippie bands Donahue had discovered, The Great Society, Sly realized it was time to get his whole new thing together. The rest is history. Sly and the Family Stone, a racially and sexually integrated band that neither black nor white record buyers could resist. Sly's brother Freddie played guitar, little sister Rosie played piano, Cynthia Robinson from one of his college bands was on trumpet, and the remarkable drummer Greg Errico was the brother of the Mojo Men's female drummer Jan Errico. In 1971, Sly delivered the famous There's a Riot Going On album, a record that showed an artist at the end of his tether. It was about this time that he was given his own record label, Stone Flower, to give him time to produce again. To my knowledge, only two singles came out of this. One, Somebody's Watching, was by his sister, Rosie, and it's a masterpiece of paranoia. The other was a record by a soul singer named Joe Hicks that sounds radical even in this day of sampling. It's called Life and Death in G&A, and it makes me wish we'd heard more from Sly Stone, the producer.
Edward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll.
Good and the bad, big and the small, in and out, not at all. If it feels good, it's all right. If it feels good, it's all right. Tell me when you feel it. Front and the back.
This is Fresh Air. The 1980s has been the warmest decade on record, and it's gotten scientists and laypeople wondering if this is a result of the greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect is a way of describing why the Earth's climate seems to be getting warmer. Ever since the Industrial Revolution, increased amounts of carbon dioxide, methane, and chlorofluorocarbons have been released into the atmosphere. And the theory is that their abundance is trapping heat and creating a warming trend. It's like in a greenhouse, where the glass allows the warmth of the sun to come through, but prevents the warm air from getting out. My guest, Stephen Schneider, is a climatologist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and the author of a new book called Global Warming. Let's get back to the 80s, the warmest decade on record. Is it coincidence, or is it the greenhouse effect? I pose the question to Stephen Schneider.
Yes, I think we probably have pretty good signs that the pollution we've already put in the past century is showing up in the record, as the 1980s is the warmest decade on record. But I can't say that for sure. The problem is a decade of intense warm does not prove that the greenhouse effect, the way it's been modified by our pollution, is here. It's very suggestive, but it doesn't absolutely prove it. The difficulty is when you listen to some scientist who says, we haven't proved it, we have to wait 10 or 20 years, that's not a free deal. Because if we wait 10 or 20 years to be certain, it's at the price of forcing the planet to have to adapt to a much larger dose of change than if we acted now. And whether, of course, to respond to that isn't a scientific question, but a value question.
Let's look at some of the proposals for how to deal with the greenhouse effect. One proposal is, well, if the temperature's rising, let's try to alter the climate to bring the temperature down. Can that be done, and what effect would that have?
It probably can be done. For example, if you use the airplanes we fly around now and you put certain chemicals in the fuel so that it would spew dust up in the stratosphere, I suppose, or you deliberately spread soot up there, I suppose you might actually be able to influence the climate. But think about this. The most probable increase for the future temperature is about 5 degrees Fahrenheit in the middle of the next century. Supposing that's wrong, and we could easily be wrong by, say, a factor of 2, supposing it only ended up 2.5 degrees, and you spread enough dust up there to try to counteract 5 degrees, but it turned out it only would have warmed 2.5, and you also made a mistake in calculating the deliberate intervention, and instead of cooling down 5, you cooled down 10. That would be an ice age. The point is the cure is likely to be worse than the disease. As long as we are as ignorant as we are about the details of how the climate works, and the only thing we really know for sure is magnitudes and rates of change, then it's very dangerous to start monkeying around. Even worse, 88 was an awfully difficult year. Nobody responsible has argued that the greenhouse effect made that one year as bad as it was. We think that that kind of event will happen with much more likelihood in the future as the planet warms up, but no one year is caused by a global trend. So think what would happen if some countries got together, started monkeying around with the climate, and then by chance an 88 occurred and Bangladesh was flooded. Imagine the potential for conflict under those circumstances. A number of years ago, I sort of jokingly said with a colleague of mine that if we're going to try to modify the climate on purpose, we better have no-fault climate disaster insurance, because you're never going to be able to prove whether or not you caused those bad random weather anomalies that happened by chance in the year of your experiment.
Well, what do you think of the posture of adaptation? Will adapt to the changes?
Well, adaptation, I think, is a good idea as long as you don't use it as an excuse to avoid prevention. Adaptation is sort of the favorite line of economists who say, well, we don't like laws and we don't like taxes and rules, so let's let the market system operate. And they have one, I think, strong argument, which is that if we spend all of our resources now hedging against potential problems in the future, we won't use any resources to make the future wealthier, and if it's wealthier, it has a better chance to adapt. So the question isn't whether you should or shouldn't adapt. I think it would be foolhardy not to adapt. And to adapt, you have to do things like have strong research programs in the agricultural universities to develop crops that can deal with warmer or warmer climates or enhanced variability. Invest in efficient irrigation systems, for example, so that, especially in the West, where water shortages are already a problem and heat could drive that worse, so that you'd have the capacity to be less harmed. And it turns out that those kinds of adaptation strategies actually make sense even if the climate doesn't change, because you're still going to get hot years just from nature or dry years, and it'll help you to get through those. So some degree of adaptation makes sense. But if you use adaptation as an excuse to avoid prevention, then I think it has the potential to be a dangerous policy. So I'm very strongly in favor of adaptation strategies. I believe it's not enough, at least not in my value system.
Would you recommend any policy changes by the United States, changes that would help curtail the greenhouse effect?
I think there are several things that the U.S. needs to do. First, we have to set a world example that we can use energy more efficiently. It's easy for us. We waste at least half our energy. It leaks out of bad windows and inefficient cars and bad industrial machines. We're actually going to save ourselves money by doing that. We make an investment, but over the 20-year lifetime of those products, it actually saves us money. That will take some policies. There are already several bills in front of Congress. Senator Tim Wirth from Colorado, Al Gore from Tennessee, Representative Claudine Schneider from Rhode Island, and these are both sides of the aisle, have submitted bills that can do that. We have to work with countries that are deforesting to help them reforest and to give them alternatives. I think that will take some foreign aid as well as some jawboning with those countries. We have to try to provide more advanced technologies to China and India, for example, so they can have more efficient technologies. We need to see to it that our water supply systems are more efficient so that we can adapt more easily to changes in the future. And we have to be careful about coastal protection, because rising sea level and the potential for increased hurricanes is very serious, and we'll have to re-examine coastal land use and see what we can do about protecting wetlands. All of those things can be done legislatively, and ultimately we have to say the more people there are on the planet, either the lower the standard of living will be or the higher the pollution, and we have got to get off, in my view, this nonsense that somehow it's interfering with people's lives to give them birth control information. Any country that wants information about family planning and wants help certainly should be given that help. That'll help reduce pollution and give them a chance to develop in less polluting ways.
It seems to me that the more scared we are about planetary disaster, the more action we're apt to take to try to stop it. And that could lead scientists such as yourself to try to be prophets of doom, you know, in the hopes of, like, scaring us all into being more responsible in our behavior. Is that something that you think some scientists fall prey to, and is that something you feel you have to hold yourself back from?
Yeah, Terry, you're right. Scientists is in what I like to call a double ethical bind. You know, on the one hand, although we don't have a Hippocratic oath like the doctors, we're sworn to tell the truth. Now, the truth doesn't mean that we know the answer. The truth means the state of the art, and the state of the art has lots of uncertainties. So that means all the caveats, all the things we don't know, and I hope I've gotten some of those across today as well. On the other hand, we're human beings. We're citizens of the planet. We want it to be a better place. Well, that means we want to advance our worldview. Mine is to reduce the risk of rapid climate change and to make development environmentally sustainable. So that has two obligations. The first one is to admit what your worldview is, and the second one is to work like mad to achieve it. Well, that means use the media. You don't get into the media easily with lots of ifs, ands, and buts and two-minute statements. Bumper sticker-length scary things are much better. So the double ethical bind, then, is finding that balance between being effective and telling the whole truth. The most important thing that people have to recognize is that making policy is not based, as scientists like, on some 99% certainty. None of us expect the insurance company to lose when we buy health insurance, but we can't afford the risk of catastrophic loss. Even though on average they make money on our health insurance, we still pay out the premium. My view is we can't afford to have catastrophically rapid climate change, and we've got to pay the premium of being a more efficient society, of cutting deforestation and so forth, and it gives us multiple benefits as well. So in that system, I think I'm quite comfortable in selling the fact that I don't want to take the risk of the high-end problems, you know, the rapid ones, but I always do try, personally at least, to say it doesn't have to be that way, and it isn't because I'm sure that things are going to be terrible that makes me advocate policy, but simply because it's better than an even bet, and that in my rationality, you don't want to take that chance, just as most of us buy health insurance.
What's the most encouraging thing you've seen in the past few years, in terms of individuals or governments taking action in the light of their knowledge of the greenhouse effect?
Two things that are encouraging. One is that the greenhouse effect is no longer an obscure scientific idea. It's a household word. I can measure that by sitting on an airplane, and if I'm reading the stuff I usually read and people start asking me questions, in fact, they can't get my work done anymore. They're always asking me questions about it, whereas even early in 88, you're most likely to be ignored as sort of a boring guy reading some junk on an airplane before that. So I think people are aware. And the second thing may not sound like it has anything to do with climate or the environment, but it is the current increasing reduction in tension among East and West, you know, the Gorbachev era, and I never thought I would be that praiseworthy of Ronald Reagan's foreign policy, but I give him a lot of credit for not getting in the way of it, but for going along with it. Because there's really no hope of coming up with the tens of billions of dollars a year that we're going to need to make globally environmentally sustainable development the priority for the next century if we're spending $1 trillion on arms. So I'm not entirely pessimistic. I'm quite optimistic that the opportunity to find the capital to solve the problem is there. We've got to keep that disengagement going, and we have to find ways to convert that money to practical uses.
Stephen Schneider is a climatologist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder. He's the author of a new book called Global Warming, published by the Sierra Club. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel, what's on All Things Considered today?
Well, we'll be hearing more about the migration taking place between East and West Germany. As you know, actually, it's between East Germany and then Hungary, and then the remarkable decision on the part of Hungary to let the East German vacationers go to Austria, from which they go to West Germany. It set in motion one of the most interesting migrations in post-war European history. We'll hear about what it's like for the East Germans who come out and make it into West Germany. We'll also hear from a West German economist about what it means for West Germany that 10,000-20,000 extra East Germans are arriving.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Writer John Gregory Dunn has a new autobiography called Harp. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
In this stab at autobiography, almost a slasher attack on who he is and how he came to be that way, John Gregory Dunn thinks out loud about his mother and his brothers, being Irish-American in Hartford, Connecticut, Princeton in the Army, murder and suicide, Henry James, Truman Capote, George Eliot, and Lillian Hellman, television talk shows, Frankfurt whorehouses, Palestinian refugee camps, cardiac surgery, and why he writes. He'd rather not think about why he writes, but heart troubles turned him introspective. He seems to have decided that he writes novels like Dutch Shay Jr., The Red, White, and Blue, and True Confessions, and nonfiction like The Studio, Vegas, and Harp, in order to even the score. In general, he's full of class hatred. Specifically, he's possessed by an Irish-American animus toward WASPs, plus some contempt for his own posturing in this resentment. The four stages of his steerage to suburbia saga, immigrant, outcast, assimilated, deracinated. The Army helped some, too. If I had not gone into the Army as an enlisted man, he says, if I had not experienced what it was like to be a have-not, I doubt that I ever would have been so professionally drawn to outsiders. On the other hand, he isn't much for wallowing in the old sod, was never deeply stirred by the Troubles, has no allegiance to the IRA, nor even any particular enthusiasm for Yates or O'Casey. Being outside is all right by him, a source of energy, a gift of material. Truman Capote's mistake, he says, was to believe himself a citizen of the world of fashion, when in fact he only had a green card. Stylistically, Dunn's inclined to ridicule. The Irish voice, he tells us, gets a kick out of frailty and misfortune. Its comedy is the comedy of the small mind and the mean spirit. Nothing lifts the heart of the Irish caroler more than the small vice, the tiny lapse, the exposed vanity. And so he ridicules himself. This is one of the things a writer does when suddenly he's afraid of dying. Dunn says he travels easier without the baggage of history, and all a history's social and genetic freight. But that freight's what we die of. When he finds out he isn't going to die, he tells his wife, I think I know how to end this book now. Well, he doesn't, really. He just stops. And his wife happens to be Joan Didion, whom he decided not to write about in his autobiography. Though I wish he had, because I think it's easier being Irish when you're married to someone who isn't, or at least I hope so. And also because, like everybody else who reads Dunn and Didion, which means everybody who's the least bit interested in American literature, I want their pillow talk. Besides, isn't your spouse another sort of history and another kind of religion against which daily you define yourself or are accommodated? But Dunn's got at something important in Harp. It's not just that after reaching out, with Gatsby, for the green light at the end of Daisy's dock, he then swats it like a mosquito. It's more that he refuses all blarney on principle. He savages any tendency to lyric afflatus. He was born to write his savage novels to nurse his bloody grudge.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Harp by John Gregory Dunn. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shura. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Donald Sutherland tells us about his latest movie role as a white South African caught up in the aftermath of the Soweto uprising. And we talk about his earlier performances in such films as Clute, MASH, and Ordinary People. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.